This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
No matter why you give, your donations can do so much more with a donor-advised fund from DAFGiving 360. You can get a tax deduction upon funding an account, and your assets can potentially grow tax-free as you recommend when and where to give. It's a tax-smart way to maximize your charitable giving from a fund with over 25 years of expertise bringing donors, financial advisors, and charities together. Make a greater impact with DAFGiving 360. Learn more at DAFGiving360.org.
When New Yorkers buy a place with Street Easy, they have the local expertise they need to stay in the city. When they buy outside the city, they have regrets.
The only way to fix this place would be to move it back to Brooklyn.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the agent you need to never leave. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Stay out of the water. That is the warning along the Jersey Shore because of rough surf and fierce rip currents thanks to Hurricane Erin.
Welcome to a wild weather edition of On Deadline. As Erin bears down on the East Coast and people wonder, is this the beginning of another devastating hurricane season? Here's Tim Jimenez at KYW News Radio with the latest.
The winds are howling, the waves crashing this morning here in Ocean City. We're right by the boardwalk. Waves today could reach 5 to 8 feet, possibly, maybe as high as 11 feet tomorrow. Ocean City, one of several shore towns banning swimming at the beaches, Atlantic City as well. Wildwood and Margate, they did so previously ahead of all this. Similar situation in Delaware, Rehoboth Beach and Bethany Beach with the swimming bans. And you can understand why when you're here, just rough this early in the morning so far. Erin not expected to make landfall or anything like that, but that just shows what kind of storm it is, the type of impact it's having here at the shore. Now, the governor, Phil Murphy, he also got involved in the conversation saying it's just not worth the risk for people to get in the water. There are people we've talked to yesterday who are traveling here, who are just trying to make the best of it, even though they can't get into the water. Hanging out on the beach, hanging out on the boardwalk, hanging out with their family and friends at their homes or wherever they're staying here. So they're just trying to get through all of this. But there are some people actually leaving because they won't be able to get into the water, Carol. So it's a whole lot going on here in terms of the weather, of course. So people are trying to make the best of what could be a scary situation if you get in the water.
No one knows hurricanes better than the people of New Orleans. Here's WWL's Tommy Tucker with more on what to expect as hurricanes begin their busiest season.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Donor-advised funds from DAFGiving 360. Your clients can donate cash, publicly traded securities, or appreciated assets like real estate. It's a simple, tax-smart way to give. Learn more at DAFGiving360.org/advisors.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House of the Home Theater sounds appealing. But that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team. Rep your city. Rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going, whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby. Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
Barry Keim joins us now, LSU health climatologist, to talk about where we are with hurricane season. So let's talk about what's going on right now out there. So why does it get so bad in August and September? Is it because the water has had a chance to heat up, or is it because of the winds blowing from here or there? Is it because of what starts off the coast of Africa? Tell me about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's mainly the sea surface temperatures, because those, you know, the hottest point in the year is not when the sun is highest in the sky, because it takes, you know, there's these lags built into the climate mm-hmm. system. So the water temperatures, peak late August into early September. And simply because of that, we get more hurricanes. Now, the Saharan dust starts to slow down a little bit deeper into the season. That's another factor. And, those are the main things, really. But I would argue the sea surface temperature is the main driver. And that those sea surface temperatures just continue to ramp up all the way up until, you know, the early part of September. The statistical peak, by the way, is September the 10th. Mm-hmm. So it's all uphill till the 10th, and then it starts ramping down. But the real heart of the season, the window, I would argue, is mid-August mm-hmm. until about the first week of October.
Tell me about Saharan dust. What is it that kicks that up, and why is it so important to knocking down the storms or helping us?
Well, this is just, you know, strong winds over the Sahara. It whips up this dust. It gets put up into the high parts of the atmosphere that, you know, and it takes this long. And these are really fine particles, mind you. Very easy to keep in suspension with a little bit of turbulence in the atmosphere. And this dust blows all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, and, you know, occasionally actually comes and messes with the optics here. Mm-hmm. And folks that have, you know, whatever they have their health system compromised for some reason. So that air is extremely dry, for starters. And secondly, it actually changes the thermal structure, the vertical structure of the atmosphere, whereby it makes the higher parts of the atmosphere a little warmer because it intercepts the sun's rays before it can strike those ocean surfaces. And that stabilizes the atmosphere and prevents the storms from forming. So Saharan dust is technically good for us, but it's better when it's way out over the ocean as opposed to hanging over Louisiana, where it's causing all sorts of respiratory problems.
So where is it now?
Well, I don't think we have any serious issues right now with the Saharan dust. So,
and, no, I mean, good see, part, the good part of it. Is it in? Is it still coming off? Mm-hmm. Into the Atlantic, or is there something going on in Africa that's shutting that down? That's what I'm trying to figure out here.
Oh, well, as we get deeper into the season, I mean, it's kind of driven by the seasonal cycles, and as we get deeper into the summer season, you know, those winds start to die down a little bit over Africa, and we don't get quite as much of it as we get deeper into the season. But earlier on, the storms over Africa definitely kicked that dust up, and it's more prominent earlier in the season than it is later in the season.
Where do we stand with El Nino, La Nina? Are we in that thing now where we have neither?
Yeah, La Nada, as
El
we
Nino.
Call it.
Okay, there you go, La Nada.
Yeah, we have neither. So we're in neutral conditions. That's, you know, neither good nor bad. I mean, obviously we want El Ninos during hurricane season because it creates extra wind shear to knock the storms down. La Nina's basically put the seasons on steroids. So we have neither So, but the sea surface temperatures are still well above normal, and we're still expecting an above normal season because of that. So just brace yourself. We're like I said, we're moving into the teeth of the season. Some of the worst storms that have ever hit us seem to come in late August or very, very early September. But we can get hit on the backside of the season, too. So, you know, we always need to be on our A game. But we're getting ready to move right into the buzzsaw. So just be prepared.
Tell me about the importance of getting the weather information from somebody that's reliable and accurate, because they got so much phony stuff out there on social media, and people get spun up and they look at a map and they think they know and they have no idea what they're looking at.
Oh, thank goodness. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, there are a lot of charlatans out in the weather world. You know, social media has propagated this in a major way. So just get your information from trusted sources. I mean, nhc.noaa.gov for hurricanes, that's really the place to go to get all your information. I mean, there are other trusted sources, you know, as long as it's affiliated with the National Weather Service or NOAA in some way, you're getting a good source. But if you got some 16-year-old in his basement, beware in a very major way.
Yeah, it's all it takes to be an influencer. You need an account and a phone. That's all you need. And all of a sudden, you're an expert and you know what you're doing, supposedly.
Speaking of trusted sources for help, how have the Trump administration cuts to FEMA affected expectations of assistance coming to areas hit by hurricanes this season? KCBS in the Bay Area tackles that question with Professor Jim Elliott from Rice University.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Donor advised funds from DAF Giving 360. Your clients can donate cash, publicly traded securities, or appreciated assets like real estate. It's a simple, tax-smart way to give. Learn more at DAFGiving360.org/advisors.
A message from a former New Yorker, presented by Street Easy.
We left Brooklyn Heights in 2021, and we miss it. We went from sharing a neighborhood with a few celebrities to sharing a neighborhood with my wife's parents.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great. But it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going, whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby. Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.
As President Trump pushes his plan to phase out FEMA after this year's hurricane season, data shows the cuts could disproportionately harm communities that supported the president. So, phasing out FEMA, what effects would that have?
Oh, they would be beyond anything I think we can imagine at this point. I think when I talk to my colleagues about the announcements on this front, we're still in that early phase of just trying to wonder what it is that's actually going to happen, right? Is this a trial balloon or is this actually going to happen? And then if it does happen, realizing that FEMA is not one thing. FEMA is an umbrella agency that does many different things and has many different programs, from individual assistance to public assistance that rebuilds things after things are damaged, after a fire or a storm or flood or whatnot, to more proactive planning and adaptation, and including overseeing the National Flood Insurance Program. So when someone says, like President Trump, that they're going to phase out FEMA, obviously the devil is going to be in the details. And at this point, we're just all wondering what that's going to look like.
So let's talk a little bit about how FEMA coordinates with state, local, tribal governments during a disaster. What are key points of collaboration?
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea is that disasters are sort of defined as such by the fact that it overwhelms local capacity, right? So the basic framework is that if you have a city or a town that says, hey, you know, we can't properly recover or repair from this recent event, we need help, they reach up to the state, and the state makes some calculations and assessments, and then reaches up to the federal government. And usually the bigger the impacts, oftentimes economic impacts, destruction of hard infrastructure, the more likely it is to go up that chain of command. But there's also a bit of loss of control as locals ask the state officials to step in. They relinquish some control, just as state officials, when they reach up to the feds, also relinquish control. So there's some give and take in that. But what the federal agencies do is provide the expertise and frankly, the experience. You know, they're paid professionals to step into a lot of counties and cities that are frankly at a point where they don't have the budgets to maintain large staffs of people just in case something happens. Right. So the feds are really a critical piece of just trying to figure out how to coordinate what needs to be done and how that's going to happen, because they're the team with the experience.
But the rhetoric coming out of the White House says that they're going to try to transfer as much of that as they can to the states. Are the states actually in a position to be able to handle what you were just talking about?
Yeah, the forecasts are no, absolutely not. It'll depend on which state you're in. And that's a combination of what threats are sort of opposed and how regularly they occur. So, for instance, here in Texas, at Rice and in Houston, we get, you know, seemingly 100-year floods every 2 to 3 years. And so there is a sense in which some places are going to be more affected by this than others. But it's not just a function of the weather or flooding or fires. It's also the capacity to actually respond with resources, right? And so this is when we get into the fact that what's really going to happen is we're going to have situations where there are going to be places where the states might not be able to afford to step in and provide the resources they might need to if the FEMA assistance isn't there. And again, this spans different types. It's the immediate assistance, you know, getting people into shelters, first responders. That's under FEMA. So how are the states going to cover that? Maybe they can cover that part, right? But then actually, the bulk of FEMA funding goes to the longer-term recovery efforts, rebuilding the schools, the bridges, the infrastructure that's needed to help that community survive and, you know, thrive and be able to generate the resources they need to recover. So if that federal aid isn't coming in, it's going to create real choices for folks. And as research has shown, the impacts are going to vary not just by place, but by the social locations and the resources of individuals and different communities in those places.
As you said, the devil is in the details, but one detail that's been coming out is that requests for assistance, instead of going to FEMA, which will be phased out according to this plan, will go directly to the White House, and the president will decide who gets aid.
Yeah, it's just hard to imagine how that would work. I can understand the political motivations. If you have people coming to ask for help, maybe you're able to negotiate some sort of other return efforts, et cetera. But that just, at this point, seems somewhat inefficient and complicated. This is about, you know, the idea of taking FEMA into the Oval Office. It's already an agency that has thousands of employees. I'm not sure how that's going to become more efficient.
I want to give some specific examples, especially from your neck of the woods. We had Hurricane Harvey in 2017, then, of course, in Louisiana, Katrina. These are very big challenges for any community. I mean, and also the readiness of FEMA. How would that impact communities in the face of a really big hurricane like those two?
Right. And just to let you know, my background, I was actually a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans and was in the city when Katrina hit. So I've been in both of these. So it's one of those things that's informed me personally as well as professionally. But right, this is the question. When you have these storms of enormous scale and scope, by definition, you're going to need outside help. It's like, if something bad happens to your family, you have to reach out to your parents or to your cousins or your kids. The network is critical to those times of resilience. Nobody's going to be able to have the resources to withstand the worst of the worst case scenarios. So what happens in those cases, it's not that FEMA is perfect and it's not that corrections can't be made. But it is the case that those need to be thought out. It's sort of like thinking about you're waking up to something. The future is going to be a little bit more challenging. So you're working out and your workout routine is going, and then you sort of pull a muscle in your arm and you decide to chop it off. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're trying to rebuild and become stronger for the future. So from my perspective, that's the real concern. And the research shows that, you know, if you don't come in and start to rebuild quickly, you can have situations where you have dislocation, displacement on massive scales. And that begins to disrupt local economies. And some of those economies are located in very strategic areas. In Houston, for instance, you know, the petrochemical infrastructure is vital to the nation's security, et cetera. So there are going to be those sorts of questions about what do we do and what does the state do if the federal money isn't forthcoming?
One wonderful. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and so inevitably there are fixed resources, right? So the state is going to have to make decisions it wouldn't otherwise make, which might mean cutting back on affordable housing subsidies or cutting back on other infrastructural programs and basically setting itself on a course to go back and become more vulnerable in a sense to future storms rather than more resilient.
Since we're on the subject of storms, hurricanes effectively hit a lot more red states than they do blue. These are people who heavily supported the president and who now, I mean, we already have Kentucky and North Carolina looking for help and not getting it from the federal government. One wonders what the fallout will be when the other states realize that they may not get any help.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a big question, and the one that sort of underlies what is this phase out likely to mean? Is it actually going to happen, or is it a basis for renegotiation? But what I would emphasize is that while it's tempting to think about sort of the idea that there might be some karmic justice, people who vote for a certain person or president and then his policies adversely affect someone, it should affect them. I'm not that sort of person to think that. We're all Americans. We're paying into a tax structure that pays up to the federal government. And increasingly, that federal government's there to serve and protect us. And one of the biggest threats we have are these growing climate challenges. So the thought that you would use people's money to provide less support to help them out of this situation seems backwards, regardless of how they vote.
You mentioned earlier that FEMA's not perfect, and just if you have an arm or a leg that doesn't work, you're not going to chop it off. What do you think the most significant challenges FEMA's facing in fulfilling its mission today?
Well, clearly rising up to the challenge of acknowledging the full set of risks that we face with our changing climate and some of the environmental risks. You know, this comes from the National Flood Insurance Program, where people are seeing their flood insurance, you know, rates and costs sort of double and potentially triple or quadruple over coming years. So that puts a real strain on Americans. So solving that question of how we socialize the risk and how do we build together as a nation to face some of these consequences is really key. And in that, one of the things that FEMA's done actually somewhat well in recent years and decades is two things. One is it used to be very reactive, right? You have a disaster, you have a big fire, you have a big flood, you have a big, you know, event, and it comes in and helps get you through the initial response and the recovery phase, but it would be reluctant to invest in the future. And so it has more programs that are beginning to experiment with that in terms of housing relocation out of the worst of the sort of risky zones or building more resilient infrastructure. So I think we need to move into that space a lot more and move forward and take advantage of those opportunities to really become a stronger and more secure nation.
Are you worried at all about us losing the economies of scale of having a federal government with all of its resources able to act quickly as opposed to, say, a small state? Let's just say Rhode Island got hit by some sort of disaster. They're not going to have the ability to move as fast and get as much as the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see this time and again in various points of research. So, for instance, wealthier places, counties, you know, Harris County, where I live in Houston or elsewhere, a lot of the funding that happens through FEMA is actually contingent upon having a staff of local experts to coordinate and sort of get the resources from the federal government. And a lot of smaller, less, you know, affluent cities and counties already running thin and so don't have that expertise, so they rely upon the federal government. So if you remove that, a lot of the infrastructure is not there. The state legislatures and the state governments, they have great people doing well-meaning work, but they are just not ready to begin to sort of step in that role and provide the resources because their budgets are constrained as well. So you're absolutely right. When we face these sort of challenges, we need all hands on deck, especially the strongest and the most available, and that's FEMA as we've done it. I will note that who knows, maybe there's a way in which FEMA emerges through some other structure. I'll just point out historically, FEMA has not been around forever, right? It was formed under Jimmy Carter in 1979 to basically pull together a lot of disparate agencies that were responsible for disaster in the federal government. So it sort of pulled them together and tried to coordinate. But the federal government has been helping with disaster relief since the early 1800s. So hopefully the federal government's commitment to doing that kind of work extends beyond FEMA. And the question is just how to make FEMA or whatever comes next better at the job that it's been doing for more than 200 years.
Are there any proposed alternate models, should FEMA be eliminated or drastically reconfigured?
You know, this gets into a lot of moving parts. I think the National Advisory Council that the Congress, U.S. Congress, put together to help advise, FEMA was an excellent source. So this is a wide-ranging, very diverse set of constituents and citizens and experts across the country who have been advising FEMA on how to improve their game. And in the process, help all of us across the country. I think the main thing is to basically empower that group and keep moving forward and innovating and thinking about how to do things in that space, not scrapping everything and starting from ground zero.
New Orleans will tell you that the effects of a hurricane can last years, even decades. As proven by the fact, some public works duties there are still being carried out from FEMA trailers brought in during Hurricane Katrina. Here's former Jefferson Parish sheriff and current WWL radio host Newell Norman on what the city learned and how lessons can be applied other places.
Today we are joined by the Port Nola Vice President of Governmental Relations, Matt Gresham, as well as Senior Advisor of the Water Institute of the Gulf of the Gulf during Katrina, Bobby Landry, who was the Chief Commercial Officer of the Port of New Orleans. And we're going to spend some time talking about reflecting on Katrina. Obviously, in not too many days, we will have the 20th anniversary of Katrina, and we've begun to bring people on to talk about it. So, gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us, Sheriff.
Thank you for joining us. So let's, why don't we just jump right into this. Take us back to August 2005 and where were you when Katrina hit? How'd you find out what, you know, was obvious? We all knew what was going on, but how'd you find out whether or not there was anything of consequence happening at the port?
You want to go ahead?
I was going to say, thank you, Matt. I'll tell you my story very quickly. I had left right before the storm with my wife, son, two dogs, and my in-laws and went up to Shreveport. and spent the night in Shreveport, then found out about all the flooding that occurred because of breaches in the levee, and I turned around and came back to the North Shore with my wife, son, and two dogs, left my in-laws up in Shreveport. Had to get a police escort into the city. A fellow by the name of Joe LeBarrier came and picked me up, and I still remember this day. He pulled into my driveway, and he gave me a shotgun. He said, "We have no idea what's going on in the city." He said, "Just pull this out the window as we drive down the city." And I think my first recollection is just how quiet and completely empty the city was. There was no trouble in terms of violence or anything getting into the city. But we did have to take a very circuitous route to get here. But I was back just a couple of days after the storm and trying to assuage our commercial customers to give us a chance to work with them.
And for you, Matt?
As an aside, I had actually just been hired by Bobby Landry 2 weeks before Hurricane Katrina struck, so I literally had a trial by fire. And so it was very dire. Gary LaGrange, our president and CEO, of course, at the time had a skeleton staff at the port. They had briefly evacuated the day after to Morgan City and then returned the next day, and our harbor police were conducting the water rescues in the lower Ninth Ward. And, Gary famously received a call during all this, right in the immediate aftermath, from the White House saying, "What do you need at the port?" And his first response was, "Well, we need water, we need blankets, we need food, you know, as anybody would that was in that kind of state of shock at the moment." And they said, "No, what do you need to reopen the port?" And I think that's when we kind of looked at each other and said, you know, we're important not only to New Orleans, but to the nation. And so that's kind of set in motion a number of things that I think really brought the port back in those days. The Maritime Administration sent Ready Reserve Fleet ships for housing from the CEO on down. We had hundreds and hundreds of workers that were able to be housed on those vessels. And the administration building here along the river was headquarters for the state police, military. We had the Iwo Jima, like I said, amphibious vessel at our cruise terminal. So literally the patrols were planned and launched really from the administration building in the immediate aftermath. So it was surreal, to say the least.
So what, as y'all began to assess and looking for any damage in the aftermath, that was a defining moment, right? You recognize and realize, hey, people that are not living in the midst of this turmoil that's going on right now are thinking about the economic impact if this port doesn't get up and running. And so I would imagine y'all had to embark upon immediate assessment of all of the assets and availability of folks to actually open the port and work the port.
Yeah, I think that's
that
where
was probably the big thing that I think we had to do. We're very fortunate from a port perspective in that our facilities were actually on the highest part of New Orleans, so they didn't flood. And even though it didn't flood our facilities, a lot of our equipment is very sensitive. When you have cranes that lift 20 tons of cargo at a time, it has to be calibrated exactly right to not only prevent people from getting injured, but preventing containers being dropped and damaging vessels or the wharves. And so people just assumed that, well, you can just start operating those cranes again. That wasn't exactly the case. And that was true with facilities up and down the river and even to the extent of some of the bridges that people had to cross. I think from my standpoint, the thing that was most ominous was the fact that we didn't have workers. The areas that were most impacted by the flood were the areas where a lot of the maritime community employees lived. As a result, the first ship that came back, which was a Likes vessel, which at that time still had a large presence in New Orleans, we had people come in from Houston to actually work the ships because they could. I mean, they were able to get transportation to come in, and I credit the ILA tremendously for working with us to that. Jim Campbell and some of the other people involved were very instrumental in that. But you're right, it's not something where you can just flip the switch and say, hey, we're open for business. There's too many intricacies that have to be dealt with. Give you another one, the trucking industry. Truckers didn't know how to get to the port. They didn't know if they could get to the port facilities. So mapping out routes where they could get into the city, pick up a load and get out were critical to getting the port back open.
So yeah, at that point, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, the sliver by the river is it was high and dry, as they called it at the time, the Uptown Wharves, which was 70% of our operations, our cargo operations. You know, obviously the Industrial Canal properties took the brunt of the damage, but we had our coal storage facility there. We had our France Road container terminal there. So obviously those were heavily, heavily impacted. And so, but we were fortunate to be able to look at the Uptown wharves and kind of from a administration standpoint, kind of Gary's leadership, he set some goals that at the time we thought might not be attainable. He said, we're going to work a ship in 2 weeks, and we did. Like Bobby said, the Likes Flyer was worked with ship's gear on September 13th, and I think that was a moment that really signaled that the city, that the port was back, and it gave hope to a lot of people that the economic engine for the region will be back.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty amazing.
Go ahead, Bob. If I can just add something on to Matt's comment, you know, he brought up a point that I'd like to emphasize, which is, you know, after the hurricane hit, and of course after the city's flooded, and all these pictures go around the world, New Orleans, there were people in our industry around the world who just assumed we would never reopen, and even the most optimistic people thought that it would be at least 6 months before we were working ships. And Matt is absolutely right. Gary LaGrange did a tremendous job, not only getting the message out that we were going to be reopened, but that we were going to reopen a lot sooner than people expected. And I think the other thing that happened, and Gary was instrumental in this, he had the senior staff get back to the port as soon as possible and start working. I mean, there were tremendous amounts of personal sacrifice on the parts of people like, you know, Dave Wagner and Joe Kuchera and everybody else on the staff, Robert Jumenville. I mean, just a bunch of people who came back and said, hey, we're going to start doing what we have to get the port back up and running. And, again, keep in mind we had a cruise industry that was very vibrant. We had a lot of cargo operations. We worked very closely with so many private sector companies that it was not an easy task. And Gary being a real promoter for what was good about the city and what was good about the port, I think helped exacerbate that whole process.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think a lot of people realize, because I know in Jefferson Parish, I had a lot of company owners call me because their competitors were putting out false information about, you know, and creating actually artificial images of their warehousing being flooded, their manufacturing being flooded. And you guys are in the competition business, and I'm sure your competition loved you on the one hand and wanted to help you on the one hand, but on the other hand, we're trying to take market share away from you because this was like an opportunity, you know, that dropped, you know, and they were not going to not try to leverage it, I would imagine, or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you know, I don't, to be honest, Lou, I don't think people really try to take advantage of it. We're in the port industry. We all know each other, and we are competitors, but I think we're friendly competitors, and we don't mind getting business from each other when it's the playing field is level. But they all know that being on a coastal location, most of our competitors, they could be in the same situation at some point in time. Now, companies do have to make decisions to reroute cargo because they have to keep business going. But I don't think that the other ports really tried to badmouth us or to do us harm. In fact, there were a lot of offers of assistance from different ports around the country. We got help from ports in South Carolina and Georgia and Florida and other parts of the country. So really, it was a really good effort on the part of the port community to work with one of its partners that had an unprecedented natural disaster.
Well, that's really nice to hear because I know a number of other folks had not a similar experience. So obviously you go through the heat of the moment, you get through this. Let's go to long-term aftermath. What changed for you guys? And what did you think about that, you know, no one ever thought or experienced something like this? And so what's changed at the port as a result of Katrina?
Well, I think the big issue, and not only for the port, but I think for a lot of people in the New Orleans region, was everybody had a preparation plan for a major hurricane, but nobody really had a real recovery plan for a disaster of that scale. You know, everything that we had that we thought that was going to work to get us back up and running pretty much failed, from our satellite phones on down to any kind of housing options that we thought we had. So it was kind of made up on the fly. And as a result of our recovery from the storm back then, I think MARAD has the Maritime Administration has put into place protocol where they have deployed ships to natural disasters around the country, just as they did here, you know, to provide housing for longshoremen, for truck drivers, for first responders. They even did that on a smaller scale during Hurricane Ida back in 2021. So I think you have a lot of lessons learned there. And also with the resiliency of the infrastructure, you know, we've rebuilt just about everything. We spent 10 years after Hurricane Katrina really recreating the capacity that we had throughout the port, namely on the Industrial Canal with the France Road Container Terminal, recreating that capacity on the river, also New Orleans coal storage with the coal storage capacity that was lost for a time. But now that's been expanded back on the Industrial Canal and expanded up at Henry Clay Avenue uptown. So I think from the really lessons learned to get through and recover from a storm like that, and also the resiliency of the infrastructure that we're building now today.
20 years after Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans continues to learn and teach powerful lessons in equity and urban planning. And this year's Morrison Lecture, nationally renowned urban planner David Dixon, who helped draft the city's post-Katrina master plan, will reframe the story of recovery, not as a saga of missteps or quest for perfection. And interestingly enough, and I know you heard this when you were here in the immediate aftermath of Katrina, there was this deep, deep concern about gentrification, right?
And it
always mystified me, because it seemed that one of the lures to the younger folks was, maybe you didn't have to do full Monty gentrification, but you were going to have drips, drabs, touches of it. And it was almost became a really bad, bad word. Your thoughts about how that will play a role moving forward?
That's a really important question. And I'm going to start by referring to something else you said. So it's interesting. New Orleans has had for a long time what the folks I'm talking about are looking for. It doesn't have to create. They're not looking for expensive restaurants and expensive beer, and they're looking for places that have authenticity and character and are fun to hang out. New Orleans has had those for decades and continues to. So it doesn't need to change or gentrify to appeal to folks. The gentrification, of course, can come and has come when a city attracts folks who have a lot of education and can command high salaries and push up housing prices. And there are lots of reasons why housing prices have gone up, but New Orleans is a very desirable place to live. Every city in America is going through some version of this right now, because urban places are considered much more desirable. Urban places, for the same reasons people like New Orleans, they like urban in general, just most cities haven't done urban as well as New Orleans. So what's very important going forward, I would say from two directions, is one, to really tap growing value to fund affordable housing. We can't afford to build in this country houses that most of us can afford to buy. If those days are over, construction costs are too high, labor costs are too high. That's another phone call. So we've got to invest public dollars in creating housing that most of us can afford. And we can't just say, well, let's build new housing and then let older housing drop in price, because what that means is the only housing available to folks who can't afford good housing is in miserable shape. And that's not the kind of country we want to be. The other side of this that's really important to remember is the best way to create jobs and jobs with opportunity for everybody,
regardless of their skills or their education, is by creating a more robust economy, and that means these days an idea economy. So the city of Buffalo, which actually has New York, which actually has a lot in common with New Orleans. It didn't have Katrina or the sort of decline New Orleans had before that. It declined because it was a Rust Belt city, but the impacts were the same. Anyway, long story short, Buffalo did a lot of research because there are a lot of folks there who said, let's think about us, not just bringing new folks to Buffalo. And Buffalo did a lot of research on the value of creating new knowledge, idea, industry jobs, and came up with, and they tested this a lot, it's a really valid statistic, that each new job they create, called a knowledge industry job in technology or biotech or something, creates five other jobs for people across the full skills spectrum. And one way that to make sure this happens is to do two things. A, make sure that New Orleans has robust programs to bring people into the workforce. You know, if you've gone to jail, you've got a jail record, you can't get a job for the rest of your life unless somebody steps in to cure that, basically to confirm that you have rehabilitated yourself. If you're a single parent, you know, somebody could dangle all the job opportunities in the world or education opportunities that they might want to, but you've got to take care of your kid unless you have a really robust daycare system and education system. So if New Orleans puts the pieces in place that unlock opportunity for everybody by attracting the new idea economy, everybody will thrive in an equitable way. Is that making sense? Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. No matter why you give, your donations can do so much more with a donor-advised fund from DAF Giving 360. You can potentially grow your charitable dollars tax-free and give now or over time by donating cash, publicly traded securities, or non-cash assets like real estate and crypto. With over 25 years of expertise bringing donors, financial advisors, and charities together, DAF Giving 360 can help you make a greater impact. Learn more at dafgiving360.org.
A message from a former New Yorker, presented by StreetEasy.
We left Brooklyn Heights in 2021, and we miss it. We went from sharing a neighborhood with a few celebrities to sharing a neighborhood with my wife's parents.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, StreetEasy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Game day or any day, your fit says it all. Hit up MLBShop.com for the latest jerseys, caps, hoodies, and accessories to keep you in the game all year long. Rep your team, rep your city, rep yourself. Gear up and game on at MLBShop.com, the official online shop of Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, there are a lot of passions. Some days it's sports, other days it's cooking, or music, or just diving into a great documentary. The thing is, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Amazon Prime isn't just about fast delivery. Though getting stuff the same day is pretty great, but it turns out it's so much more. Prime Video, Amazon Music, the whole range of services. It's like a hub for all kinds of curiosity. Prime helps people stay connected to what matters and keeps the journey of exploration going. Whether it's watching something inspiring, listening to a new artist, or getting gear delivered fast to chase a new hobby, Prime makes it easier to dive in. So yeah, whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever sparks interest. Amazon.com/Prime.